Welcome to the World of Wisdom podcast. My name is Amit Paul, and today, well, this is a conversation that I've been looking forward to, and then I had forgotten about it. And then as I was reminded that it was going to happen, I got very curious again. And so we're going to be talking about, I think, nesting and the different ways of raising kids and maybe ourselves and maybe different contexts for being, I'll venture and say, maybe more human or more alive or less limited, perhaps. We'll see. But I'm very, very honored to be able to welcome you to the podcast, Tarsia Narváez.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you.
I tend to get the hardest question out of the way to start with. So just be warned, maybe it's not that hard even. Who are you, Tarsia Narváez?
I'm a member of the Earth community. I am a presence on the Earth as one of many persons, human and non-human, who are here to flourish and enjoy being together. And my work is about encouraging people to return to understanding that and to live their lives in a way that is enhancing of one another. And we've done so many things in the last millennia, last few hundred years, last decades to undermine that way of being and that way of understanding. So I'm a public educator now. It's my maybe eighth career. So I've been collecting experiences and insights along the way, and now it's time to share as much as possible.
How did you come to this particular, or maybe it's not that particular even, but this general inquiry?
Right. Well, I spent half my childhood outside the United States, the other half inside in Minnesota primarily. And we lived in, outside of the States, we lived in Spanish-speaking countries, so-called third world countries often. And I would see kids my age on street corners selling gum. They were in rags, barefoot, often not bathed. I would come back to the States and then see all this super abundance of stuff and wastefulness, and I couldn't understand the world. It was so unjust. What's wrong? So the sense of something is wrong has been with me from an early age. But I've had a lot of different interests. So I was a music major in college, a church organist, as a result, a classroom teacher, music teacher, and later on a classroom Spanish teacher, and different things. And I also went to seminary looking for, you know, the answer, what's wrong, but I didn't find it there. And I grew up as a fundamentalist Christian, and not only were women not leaders, you were against business and science and, you know, the world, that's the realm of Caesar, you know, instead of the realm of Christianity. And so I've ended up going to all the realms now. And, never say never, right? I was never going to be a business person, but I started my own business when I was in seminary. And then I wasn't a science. What? Then I became a social scientist. So because the truth is spread out, it's like a golden thread that every discipline has a little piece of. And you can't find the truth until you put it all together, all the little pieces from all the different areas. So that's the kind of, so my work in essentially human flourishing, starting with babies, infants, in particular, began with the Iraq War. The Iraq War was just such a shock to me that people would go to war for no reasons. I was one of the millions, among the millions that protested ahead of time. And I then realized there was, you know, what's wrong with people that they would do that, and how can they be so easily convinced? And that led me to all this interdisciplinary reading, which included neuroscience and neurobiology and the early experience, interpersonal neurobiology, and the anthropologists showing us hunter-gatherer childhoods that all over the world, the hunter-gatherers raise their children this way. And I wonder if it matters, says one of the anthropologists, Mel McConnor. And then finding affective neuroscience, all the animal mammalian research on how our brains are very similar to other mammalian brains and their emotion systems and how they are shaped by early experience. And so I put all that together, and that's come about to be called the Evolve Nest, that we have forgotten our way. We forgot the wellness pathway of our ancestors that, you know, helped us all flourish and get along in the biological or ecological community, and not be destructive, but constructive in terms of having a happy, healthy life.
Yeah, that's the right path for this conversation, to talk a little bit more about the evolved nest and what it is. What came up for me is like this inquiry that I've been having in my for myself is like that in terms of sort of time and how we seem to live in three different, at least, times. That there's something about sort of our individual, individual, what seems to be individual cognition, and how that sort of has its time frame over a lifetime, and then you have sort of the cultural times stacked on top of, and sort of the programming or the preconditions that we get from the sense of normality or something like that from the cultural, and then like in communication with the biological time frame or like this dissipative structure that we call the body, that how that evolves and moves and so forth, but it shifts on a much longer sort of time frame than the culture or the individual cognition. And I know that for myself with my kids, that I had been very much raised up in control and command, sort of control dominance sort of paradigm with my parents, and my wife fortunately hadn't. So she was much sort of more lenient and more close and present with them. And now I think they have there's a soup in them. But then when I came across your work, I was like, oh, it makes so much sense. So I just wanted to kind of preface it a little bit, but then at the same time, just leave it open to what is the sort of the bulk of your work? Maybe like what are we doing at the moment, and what is the direction, like a more constructive direction towards human flourishing?
So in general, we've forgot who we are, right? We've taken up the so-called Western Enlightenment view that we are separate from nature, we're superior to nature, we can control and manipulate it. And that includes babies, it includes ourselves, our bodies, you know, they're kind of inferior to reason, our intellect. We can figure it all out with our intellect and apply our models, and the things will be so much better than nature. Nature's too imperfect and too wasteful and too gooey, too physical. Don't touch me. I want to be in my ivory tower mind and be an onlooker, not really get involved. You know, that's the Western intellect view is, you know, Descartes in his room thinking in front of the fireplace, you know, and deciding I know who I am. It's all in my head. So yeah. We've got strange and the elites. It was, you know, this viewpoint was taken up as a way to divorce themselves from everyone else. You know, it's all about individuality, and it's a dog eat dog world. And Darwin's theory, yeah, you know, tapped into that, this kind of economic man idea. And so the elites, the aristocrats, the privileged started to, at least rationalize and justify their superiority and their entitlements. And then that leaked down into the culture, so that everyone, you know, starts to feel superior to somebody, and especially nature and natural things and women, right, and babies and bodies and all that. So we've become divorced from the earth, from earth consciousness, and we are so destructive because we're so disconnected from our own spirits, our own intuitions, our own experiences, and are taught instead to believe these ideas these ideas are more important than our experiences. So, and that's, you know, so everyone's mad because they feel their needs are not getting met, obviously. And they're told it's their fault. If there's any problem, it's you, or it's those green people over there. Blame them, you know, and then you put all your energy of your anger towards those green people. And so it's a crazy world right now because we forgot our way. When we call it the wellness informed pathway, we've forgotten. We're now on the trauma inducing pathway. I also have a movie, Breaking the Cycle. So the cycle that we're in is one of competitive detachment, where you undercare for the young. They develop dysregulated systems of all kinds, immune system, stress response system, endocrine system, digestion, whatever, everything is kind of dysregulated. They become adults who aren't very well or very wise, who don't know any better, and create a culture that keeps this undercare, lack of evolved nestedness going. They keep it going because that's what they think is normal, and it keeps getting worse because every generation is even less nurturing than the previous one. Whereas our heritage for 2 million years before this little tiny, you know, few moments of one part of the human species had this weird idea of being divorced from nature and from the earth. Our heritage is the cycle of cooperative companionship, where you provide for all the basic needs of the young, especially, but everyone's needs. It's like it's a cycle of gifting, and nature's economy is a gift economy. And our economy traditionally was a maternal gift economy, where everyone's needs are met, and you know, you don't get all upset. You're just generous because you know you could die any moment. So let's be in this together. And then you would develop a well-functioning neurobiology, a psychosocial neurobiology. And you become an adult who actually can become wise and well and happy and guiding a wise elder. And then these adults keep the cycle going. And you can see this in the Blackfoot tradition. Abraham Maslow was inspired by the Blackfoot. He was spent a few weeks there with them one summer back in the 30s, I think. And he had been an experimental psychologist, Abraham Maslow, who's known for basic needs. And he was so impressed that, gee, no one's anxious, depressed, neurotic here. What's going on? And so he shifted his whole enterprise, his whole research towards looking at self-actualization. But he got it kind of upside down. So he says, oh, you got to have your physical needs met, your safety, esteem, love, all that. And he has a hierarchy of it, right? And then finally, you get to self-actualization. Well, the Blackfoot, you start with self-actualization. All those things are needed now, right? You need love now. And that, the evolved nest provides all that now. It's the love, esteem, affection, you know, meaning. All these things are needed from the beginning, and you build your self-actualization. But that's not the end point for the Blackfoot or for Indigenous folks. It's community actualization. You actualize an individual so that the community is going to flourish, and then that community is going to last into the future for future generations, the 7 generations ahead, right? Honoring the ancestors, honoring the future generations. So the Maslow shifted it to you know, individualistic kind of westernized intellectual kind of ideas and pathways, and you know, so he forgot, he didn't know either. But that's what people do. Whatever culture you have, your frameworks you impose on the information or experiences you're having. E. Richard Sorensen, an anthropologist, spent, I don't know how many years traveling and living with what he calls pre-conquest cultures all over the world. And he filmed them. And he says it took him decades to realize what he had experienced. He had to watch his films over and over. And then he realized, oh, pre-conquest cultures are very different from post-conquest. Pre-conquest, they're there. They're so intertwined, and they're able to pick up on signals without talking about it. You know, they can just see, perceive, you know, touch. You get a certain touch, and you know what the communication is. And he said it's so hard for a post-conquest culture person to perceive. Right. So part of our issue, our big issue, is our perception has been shaped so narrowly now that we've we can hardly perceive the communications from the rest of nature. And that's what we have to get back to, in part.
But, the timeline that you're looking at in terms of when we started narrowing perceptions in this way, is it sort of the Enlightenment timeline, or is it more like the invention of the plow timeline? Like, is it a few hundred years, or is it a few thousand years, or like what is the, how fast is this, or like when did it begin?
Yeah, it's a good question, because it's a puzzle. It's hard to be precise about it. I think it's civilization. Sure. Generally, so that would be going back to Sumer. As soon as you start having hierarchy and coercion, whenever you start to coerce people, you are now undermining the unfolding of their spirit, their uniqueness, their gift. And that's back, thousands of years ago, but it's just gotten worse. So more and more coercion. And today, I mean, part of it is the Western Enlightenment view has even made enhanced the coercion, because it's the divorcing from the natural way of things. At least people understood there's a natural developmental course for various things. Even during civilization, there was some understanding of that. But Western Enlightenment view is like, oh no, we don't want to pay any attention to tradition, to natural systems. No, I can think of it all in my head and make it better. So it's this weird Platonic idealism that's now parents are guided by that idealism. Make your child do this or that, teach them how to read when they're three or whatever, all this crazy, contrary to what's best for that child, what's normal and natural, what's evolved. And without this awareness of effects, so we get stuck in this scientism, and especially the randomized controlled trials, the RCTs, the gold standard for knowing anything, is you randomly assign people to one group or another in the experimental group, then you see if there's any difference in the outcomes between the ones who weren't experimented on and the ones who were, and then you say, aha, this is the cause, this is this or that, and that's insanity, because the world is so complicated. Everything's intertwined. There's always other things going on. There's a few things you can learn that way, but you can't rely on that for your only source of knowledge. Our source of knowledge should be from our own experiences, but they have to be good experiences too. You can learn the wrong things. You grew up in a violent family. Your intuitions about how to get along with other people aren't going to be the greatest, when you leave that context. So we have to pay attention to the environments in which we're putting raising children, and make sure that we are helping them develop the right intuitions, because we learn very quickly from our, what works and doesn't work in a particular environment. That's how we learn effortlessly. And so we have to pay attention to having really supportive environments, or else the wrong things get learned in early life, the wrong neurobiology gets set up. Unhealthy one.
I think that's really, because I mean that certainly describes sort of my, I guess, recovery would be a good, but like to come back into contact with my intuition, and like to all of a sudden there is this little, I wouldn't call it voice, but there is this sort of sense of knowing or something like that is helping me out. Like all of a sudden there's like a certain sense, like I'll be in a meeting. And I'll feel like, no, this is not what I should be doing right now. And then as this sort of opening or the possibility to listen to it and to take that seriously, which has sort of, I never allowed myself to do that earlier, but there's a certain awakening to that. And you were speaking to perception before. I'm curious to kind of dive into maybe those two cycles, the destructive one and the positive one, a bit more. And then maybe if you could even sort of make it even more tangible and like put it in terms of examples of I don't know, I guess childhood experiences or even workplace experiences or something that would, propagate the one cycle versus the other.
All right. Yes. Yeah. And so, fostering that intuition, that inner spirit, yeah, it's really important. That's one way to heal, right? Is to start feeling those little interior nudges. Those are things that your deeper self knows and is trying to guide you, right? Your deeper intelligence, in a way. And we don't know what that means, and there's no way to measure it really in a scientific way. So the two cycles, maybe I'll start with a good one. The good one is the cycle of cooperative companionship. And that starts with a welcoming experience. So I'm going to just mention the evolved nest components. So soothing prenatal and perinatal experiences for that child. Of course, that means for the mother, where she feels like the baby that she's carrying is welcomed. The fetus that she's carrying is welcomed. And so her neurobiology or biochemistry is in a positive state, so that that baby's growing in a good trajectory for health. Maybe I have to contrast these two methods as we go. So in contrast would be a mother who's stressed out all the time, or the community doesn't want the baby, doesn't want her, whatever it is. And then her biochemistry is going to be one that's going to stress the baby and make their brain grow in a stress reactive way, so that when they're born, they're more irritable, for example. And then they're harder to take care of.
Sorry, just pulling it, like what's bubbling up is sort of the Gregory Bateson's work on like the double bind, like this sort of disconnect between sort of the schizophrenic mother that has a verbal communication and then an energetic communication that is opposite. So it's like, in the sort of destructive cycle where there is a verbal recognition that, oh, this is so wonderful and this is so lovely and this is so great. But then at the other end, on the energetic level or on the somatic level, or I don't know which, you know, how to phrase that really, but the other communications are that, oh, we don't want this. This is not like, this is a disruption. This is something. And I'm just wanted to kind of highlight that as a third possibility, or related to the destructive cycle, I guess.
Right. So maybe pause for a second, digress. So when we are raised in a proper way, our gut feelings, our hearts, our intellect, our spirits are all coordinated. We are flowing as one systematic presence in the world. When we're undercared for, our gut is going to learn to go for self-protection and brace against anything that's scary or whatever. You start to put up your defenses very easily. This happens in milliseconds. Your heart will be kind of pretty much suppressed because no one listened to you, really. No one attended to you. And so you had to squelch the intuitions, the spirit. And then your intellect is taught in school to be a certain way and to learn these things that are right and the rules and the way to talk properly and fit in the culture, right? And spirit is kind of absent. It's sort of in the background. So then this mother you're talking about has learned what the cultural things to do and say are and what she should be like, but her gut is not there. Her heart is missing, or it's empty, or it's, you know, ailing. And so then you get this conflict that's going on. So that's part of what's going on with our child raising in families, poor families, where they're all kind of dysregulated. That's what dysregulation is. This is a lack of coordination among systems. And then the superficial veneer of intellect telling you how you should be. And then you're trying to do that. But it's really hard when you're dysregulated. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I'll pause each time for. So I'm still on the prenatal, perinatal. That's number one of the evolved nest. So birth then in a positive evolved nest way is soothing. The child is not rushed. Is not the due dates are, you know, the child. It's up to the child when the due date is, really. Doctors are guessing for babies. Babies vary by about 55 days how long they stay in the womb. So it's really a guess. And there's no pressure. The mom's in has to be in good shape, right? And has been welcoming the baby so that things go rather rapidly. Is healthy. Of course, there's always emergencies now, and we have a lot of people who are not fit, so that makes it much more difficult. But in the soothing birth, you haven't naturalistic evolved nest birth. You're not taking drugs, so you're not rushing the labor. You're not which then makes the pain worse. So then you have to take a painkiller, and that all that stuff's going to drug the baby. The baby does not have the capacity to filter it out. The liver function doesn't work for a while, so they're going to come out drugged, and they will be unable to bond, unable to breastfeed because they're so lethargic. And that kind of wrecks that magic hour right after birth. In a naturalistic condition is when the moms and the babies' bodies are reward systems. All they're ready to glom onto each other as a forever bond. And if you mess that up with medicalized interference, taking the baby away to do this or that, or causing pain, you're undermining that successful long-term relationship. So birth and post-birth times then should be soothing and supportive for mom and baby. And that means no sugar water, which hospitals give routinely in the United States to babies. That's undermining the microbiome. That's imprinting them for wanting sweet things. It undermines the film that breastfeeding otherwise provides as a protective factor throughout the intestines and so on. Anyway, And what happens, there was a study in the 50s comparing Ugandan home birth babies, hospital birth babies, European and American birth babies. Home birth babies are ready and are so happy. They're smiling within a few days. They are able to sit up in the second day and look in the eye their mother. In hospital births, babies cannot do that for like several months. Because they've been so drugged and interfered with that what they do is they sleep most of the time. And when they're awake, they're crying because they're so stressed still. All the hormones of stress, birth stress hormones to get them through the birth process are still there because they never got the soothing post-birth experience of being on mom's skin and breastfeeding or suckling. So anyway, that's number one.
Yeah.
Number two, do you have any?
No, I just, I'm still, you said plus minus 55 days. And I was trying to calculate like that gap. That was just, I didn't know. It's a bigger gap than I've heard.
Right. That's Ashley Montague.
And
then number two is the, breastfeeding. And breastfeeding is just this, breast milk is just this magic elixir. It's on demand, the ingredients, you know, the baby's saliva indicates to the mother whether it's a boy or a girl. Milk is different. And the milk in the morning is different from the milk at night. Energizing in the morning, sleep-inducing at night. If there's an infectious agent in the region, baby's saliva will signal it. The mother will create an antibody. So it's just this magical 80% alive liquid that babies are supposed to ingest frequently because it's the thin kind of milk, not the thick. Predators have thick milk so the mother can go off and hunt. Ours is thin, which means you have to stay close to mom and feed at will frequently, every 20 minutes as a newborn, for example. And that's flooding the brain and with all the right hormones and ingredients to build the brain properly. So our species, on average around the world in these hunter-gatherer communities, wean their children at age 4, which usually blows the mind of Westerners. Like, what? Are you kidding me? Infant formula is like poultry in comparison, right? It's not alive. It's got a few dozen ingredients. Breast milk has thousands of ingredients. We hardly understand it. And formula is not regulated well, and it's it's not even human. On and on you could say, but you know what? Mothers have been convinced by marketing and advertising that it's almost as good as breast milk. So that's a problem and is linked to obesity and all sorts of health problems when you don't have breast milk. So you want to breastfeed as long as possible. And yeah, I could say more about it, but that's number two.
Mm-hmm.
Number three is affectionate touch. Pretty much 24/7 babies need to be touched and carried and held and rocked. That's what they expect. They are like fetuses of other animals till about 18 months of age. So they need a womb with a view. That's Ashley Montague's term again, exterogestation. So much is growing. The brain is growing so quickly, right? Thousands or millions of synapses a second. And every few minutes, the baby's a different baby. So you want to make sure you're being supportive of that baby now in this moment, because who knows what's growing? Every baby is different, right? So you want to provide the evolved nest so that they're calm all the time. And affectionate touch is one way to do that. They expect that to be with you all the time. Otherwise, systems get dysregulated. And there's welcoming, just kind of a general welcoming, that they feel like they belong, they matter to the community, not just to mom. All these things in the evolved nest are not for mother alone or mother and father alone. It's the village of care. So multiple nurturers, because, you know, everyone needs a break, everyone needs to rest, and the baby needs to learn to get along with lots of different people, not just one. They're you know, learning flexible attunement to others. Their relational intelligences are being established in those early months and years. So you want to have them with lots of different experiences. In some communities, they even pass the baby around for breastfeeding purposes. So it's not just the mother's milk, mm-hmm. or mother's breast or mother's smell. And even in even if you're not doing the breastfeeding sharing, passing from, according to the baby's signals, whether they want it or not, passing from one person to another and letting them spend time in different kinds of arms gets them used to different smells and different ways of people holding and moving. That's going to build much more intelligence than just having one kind of experience with one person or two. And then no negative touch, so no spanking, no punishment of any kind. Mm-hmm. That's going to shift the trajectory away from health. It's going to automatically put you in a stress reaction, the child, and then your cortisol increases. That if it gets very high, like if you leave a baby to cry, leave them alone, the cortisol is getting up there and it's going to melt the brain connections, not grow them. If it grows anything, it's going to grow, you know, the aggravating kinds of ways of being, you know, screaming to get your needs met, scream, scream, scream. And then finally somebody comes, oh, that worked. Okay, now I know. Or if you scream and nobody comes, you have to shut down or you're going to die, use up all your energy, right? Well, then you've learned something else. So it's you're setting patterns in those early months, early couple years of how that person's going to be, the personality, their how well they get along with others, whether they're going to be cooperative or not, depends on how cooperative the caregivers were with the baby. If the baby's not getting their needs met and they signal and no one's listening, why should they be cooperative with anyone? You just taught them it's not important, right? So a lot of psychology going on with the neurobiology here. Then, so responsive relationships is another one. So responsiveness means that you move in when that baby starts to signal their needs. You don't wait for a baby to cry. That's a late signal. Their stress is cortisol. Their hormones are already in play. You want to avoid that. You want to then notice instead when they start to make a face or wiggle a little bit and gesture. They're telling you something's not right. That's when you move in and try to comfort them. Because you want to keep them in that optimal aroused state while they're growing so quickly. Body grows slowly for our species, but the brain grows very quickly. And that brain needs a very supportive environment. Then there's free play, self-directed free play. Mm-hmm. And that means the child, even babies are ready to play, to interact and start to play games with their parents from a young age. Then tease. But it means that the child's in charge. And so you run around and play chase, climb trees, play with multiple age playmates, not just the same age. Same age groupings are going to increase risk taking and competition, whereas multiple age is going to increase cooperation, because the young like to learn from the older and the older love to teach the younger. So it's much more of a cooperative setting. That's our heritage. And free play is not.
But that's.
Yeah.
No, sorry. That's really. Say something more about the risk taking part. That felt that I was like, what?
Yeah. So if you put kids in the same age group together, like in a classroom of the same, what do they have to learn from the others? not a lot, because they're the same age, right? So it's risk taking. They're going to encourage in peers in adolescence, they're ready for risk taking. And if you put them in with peers, their risk taking is going to be much more dangerous than if their risk taking is in with a multiple aged group. And our heritage is to live daily life with multiple ages all the time. You don't separate yourself out in an age group. Even the play groups are multi-age. And tribes, that's a more complex form of community than hunter-gatherers. Tribes may want to go to war or go, you know, invade or whatever. Sometimes war doesn't mean war in our sense. It's just, you know, go bug those people over there and steal a horse or something. You have to separate the men out. The males have to go separate themselves for a while so that the testosterone levels go up. Because our normal way of being, when we're with children, when men are with children, their testosterone levels are going to go down, are going to be normally lower than what we think is normal. Because you have to be empathic. You have to be there. You're playing with the kids. You know, it's an enjoyable life. But then you have to go off and maybe hunt, and you want your testosterone to go up. So you separate yourself from the children. So I think we should have babies in every corporate boardroom so that the testosterone is at normal levels.
Of course.
And so that they're thinking about the effects of their decisions on the future generations.
Yeah. It's tricky with child labor laws, maybe, but.
But they can be visited.
Right. But it's so obvious when you say that. And yeah, I just felt my mind go, what?
Yeah. All right. So I think two more. There's two more. One is nature immersion and connection. So we co-evolve with the natural world, you know, and we co-evolve being outside, spending our times outside a lot. There's a study recently that found that people in the United States, USians, spend on average 24 hours a year outside.
A year?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh my goodness. Talk about disconnection, right? So it's like running from your house to the car. Wow.
A year. Yeah, that's 2 hours a month. Yeah. Wow.
So nature immersion, we know, is important for, you know, mental health and physical well-being. You can, there's various things you can do for that to improve it. And then the last one is routine or regular healing practices, as we get out of balance rather easily as a species, because we make choices and then we realize that was a bad choice and then we feel bad or we hurt something, somebody. So in our ancestral context, hunter-gatherer context, they have regular healing, community healing practices, trance, dancing, and singing. And these can be joyous even, but also for grieving. The San Bushmen of Central Africa, when they're asked, well, how often do you have a grieving ceremony? They'll think, oh, maybe once a week. And then, but sometimes every day. So it depends, right? So we have to get back to that. The Protestant Reformation kind of shut down the community wailing and grieving, community funeral processions and such. We have to get back to letting those emotions out, because if we don't, if we stuff the emotions, we're going to have ill health. And then we'll also build resentment against others because we haven't been able to be ourselves. Well, then we're not going to let them be themselves, you know, whatever it is. So those are the nine components.
It's so fascinating how and it struck me that when I heard you speak at the Local Futures Conference as well, it's like how obvious most of this stuff is. And then, of course, like somewhere here, there's like quite a bit of sort of guilt / sort of shame that's kind of creeping in for me, because I'm also seeing like how many of these patterns I've been unable to like deliver to my kids in the way that I would have wanted them to. And I mean, in a way they're now like 6 and 8. So it's time. There's probably still time for some of these to be to be there and to be more constructive with. And I know that, I mean, I've done a lot of shifting over the past few years. So there's been, but there's it's tricky to be with. And it's easy to kind of, I find myself kind of thinking also, although like, I've looked at your research and so forth, and then, but I kind of defend myself against it a little bit as well. I'm like, no, but it can't be that important. Or like, oh, but that seems a little bit extreme, or like there are all these like defense mechanisms that come up in me because of, and I would attribute them to sort of shame, guilt, shame, guilt is.
Yeah. You're not alone. When I make presentations to international audiences, people from the global South, so-called, they nod their heads, and then they appreciate knowing that the science is behind what they know is, you know, the way to raise a child. And the global North people are the ones who go, what? I'm not going to do that. Or how can you say that to me? I had a philosopher call me a Nazi because I was talking about the importance of touch for your children. Mm. So it's, we have gotten so far away from what we think is the way to raise children that it seems unethical to shift away from what we were taught and how we were raised, right? But we have to understand the neurobiology, understand that we've been around for a couple million years with these practices. And many of these practices I've mentioned are more than 75 million years old. They've come, you know, through the tree of life. And we share with many other animals. My latest book with Gay Bradshaw is about that. The Evolved Nest, Nature's Way of Raising Children and Creating Connected Communities. We go through each component of the nest with the different animals and talk about human nest as well.
I think, and it's particularly interesting, and that's also like, I think you said in your talk at the conference, something around that if we sort of layer on top of all of this, we layer technology on top of it, and how technology is built and which systems it rewards and so forth, like how it, literally informs us, like how it shapes our neurobiology and neurophysiology and so forth. Then that really hit home with me, that there's this sort of movement towards us becoming what we say that we are, like sort of in the less interpreted Darwinian, like we're just chimps with tools basically, and how we're interacting with the world and how we're racing one another now, like it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy almost, or something like that. I don't know if you want to speak more to that, but that was really sort of also like a jolt for me. It's like, oh, of course, you know, but I hadn't seen it before.
Yeah. So our heritage, our shift away from the chimpanzee and bonobo lines, we split off from them years ago. Some anthropologists argue that happened because of our cooperative child raising practices. So the evolved nest, essentially, that's how we became more social, we have a large social brain. We have all at least evolved a large social brain. Our brains have been shrinking, I think, from the lack of the evolved nest, but that's my speculation. But we evolved this large brain in order to read minds and to share our emotions and thoughts with others. Chimpanzees cannot read minds. They don't do a natural we orientation when you're in the room together or something in experiments. And so our capacity to, you know, share and be generous, that's part of us too, which again, capitalism kind of shuts down. And so capitalism and patriarchy have tried to make everything static and, you know, categorizable. This is left brain stuff. So the left brain loves static categories, loves dead things, you know, can't deal with dynamism and flow and relationships. What? Ah. And so that's the Western Enlightenment pushing us over into left brain thinking as if that's the superior way of being a human being. Tell that to our ancestors who, you know, lived quite well without that awareness. Actually, you know, Western wisdom traditions of the world, left brain, the thinking, the intellect is a very dangerous aspect of ourselves. It's a useful tool at times, but if you start living there too much, you start to think you're a thinker, and that's what humans are. Whoa, beware, danger, danger. So all the Western traditions know, wisdom traditions know that. And somehow we don't know that in the Western world, right? So I forgot where I was going.
No, yeah, but towards the sort of the regression, if you will, maybe towards our chimp and bonobie heritage,
right?
Because of how we are.
Yeah. And so when we don't provide the nest, we are now shaping the child into more of a chimpanzee, the stereotypic chimpanzees. Chimpanzees are a little more social than the stereotype. I just heard a talk last week. So, the stereotype is that chimpanzees are going to be violent and domineering. You know, it's male dominance. Well, that's what we're doing, especially to boys. Boys need more of the nest, and they need it for longer because they mature more slowly and they have less built-in resilience than girls. So they need much more nurturance, more longer, more breastfeeding, more affectionate touch, more play, more mentorship, more responsiveness than the girls. Because girls, you know, can manage to some degree with less. But what happens when you don't provide the nest and you leave babies to cry, you leave them alone, you put them in front of a screen instead of a human being, instead of lots of different relationships and freedom to roam and learn. When you kind of lock them up in this very static world inside four walls, inside a crib or a playpen or a carrier, you're strapped in, you've just now encouraged them to rely on what's innate. They're innate systems. What are you born with? Fear system, a rage system, a panic system, a so-called reptilian brain, right? You enhance that when you stress them out. And you don't grow what's supposed to be growing, which is all this relational attunement and social and emotional intelligence has to be grown after birth, because it's culturally specific in how you look at people and touch them and everything. So those things then don't grow. And then you send them to school and you're teaching the intellect. You know, this stuff is so important. Remember, this is the rule. Da, 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 da. But they're reliant on their gut, which is oriented to self-protection because they haven't been feeling safe. So their fear system and their rage system and their panic systems have been enhanced. They easily get triggered into those. And then they can't think very well because when the stress response kicks in, your blood flow actually shifts away from your higher order thinking and goes to your muscles for flight or fight, right? That's just the way it works. There's no way around it. And so a child who's been undercared for and stressed a lot is going to be more easily triggered and then is not going to learn very well, is not going to be open-hearted, open-minded, going to be much more oriented to what worked in the past. Scripts, give me a script, give me an ideology and tell me something that makes me feel safe, superior and safe usually. And then you've got all these problems we have all over the world where we've undercared for people, neglected them, because the nest needs to continue throughout adolescence, throughout early adulthood, into our whole lives. Otherwise, we get off kilter, and our egos can come into play and take over. And a child who's undercared for in those early years has to build an ego to protect themselves. They have to have some buffer. And that ego then, is sort of an artificial cloak. They're not connected to their spirit and their heart, which would know that they're connected to everything. Everything's one. We're all in this together. But that's what was thwarted in those early years.
It's fascinating. I'm also wondering, and now I'm asking for some help here to deal with my shame and my guilt. But what are the pathways, if you will, like if we are in the culture that we are in, and I mean, most of my listeners are certainly in the Northwestern hemisphere. There's a difference for sure between the US and Sweden, where I've been born and raised, culturally as well. But on the, to sort of break this, the negative cycle or to step out of it. I mean, one of the things that I said before we started recording was like, what happens like as we, because I just moved 2 years ago, for instance, which was a huge opportunity for me to reinvent some of my connections and reinvent some of my context and how I show up in the world. And I'm wondering also, like, in terms of when you switch maybe workplaces, or when you switch schools or friend groups, or like whatever, when you re-embed yourself in different social contexts, like when or what or if there are any opportunities to kind of rediscover or heal, like what are the most constructive strategies, or like what can we watch out for to kind of tag on to flows that are different than the destructive cycle, if you will?
It's a big question. Let's start with parenting.
Yeah.
So let's just assume that I'm talking to parents who didn't know these things when they were raising their children, right? So what can you do now? Well, the best way, so actually, let me just digress here for a second. What's undermined when the nest is not provided in early years is right hemisphere development. Right hemisphere development is that it governs our social emotional intelligence. It at least initially, things get more complicated with development, but initially, and it governs our self-regulation, like the vagus nerve, which is the 10th cranial nerve, which links to all the major systems of the body. These things, it has to be set up properly with the evolved nest, or else it can give you problems in any of those areas later on. And so the right hemisphere is our the seat of our higher consciousness too. It's empathy. It gets us a sense of being connected to others, and it's wired to be connected to the older parts of the brain, but also pulling in the signals from the world. The left hemisphere is just wired to itself, so it just likes to talk to itself and thinks it's the superior aspect of ourselves. Ian McGilchrist's work, The Master and His Emissary, talks about this, right? In the left brain, you don't want to encourage it too much, because this is the big ego thing, right? In our ancestral context, when a hunter was successful, the other hunters would get worried, right? You know, they got a big animal, uh-oh. And so they start to tease the successful hunter and say, that's such a small thing. We should go back and find a rabbit would be bigger, you know. And then they try to, you know, get the guy to laugh, because laughing brings you back down to being in the egalitarian mode, which our hunter-gatherer cousins are in, which is what you are learning when your right hemisphere is being built and co-constructed well. So that when you ask the hunters, why do you do that? Why are you teasing him? If we didn't do that, he would become dangerous. Right, because the big ego is a dangerous thing, because you start to feel entitled. And you can see that all over the world, with their wealthy people are just keeping hoarding all their money, and they think they're entitled to have another yacht or add another yacht to their dozen things like that. So you have to make sure the ego doesn't get too big. But what we do with undercare is we create the big egos, because what else are they going to do? They're so scared, these little babies, especially the boys. What else are they going to do? They move into the dominance, submission way of looking at the world. If you're not dominant, you're a loser, right? Trumpism. So it's, we've set ourselves up for the problems we're having because we forgot our wellness pathway. So anyway, I've digressed again from, what was I talking about?
What are the off-ramps from the current pathway, if you will? Are there bridges to, and where are they?
Yes. And so the most important thing to do is to build that right hemisphere again. And the way it grows throughout life, when you're in the present moment and socially connecting, it will grow. So that's why I always use play. I encourage people to play with a child from 0 to 7 years old or so, because they're ready to be spontaneous and run around and play. And if you're not there with them emotionally, relationally present in the moment, they'll stop playing with you. So they teach you. Children are going to teach us. The adults in the West have to step away. Step away from the children, unless it's a baby. Baby, you give everything to, right? But once they reach 5, 6, 7, you step away and let them follow their own spirit always. Let them unfold. Don't be, telling them what to do all the time. They have an inner compass that's going to guide them. They learn from observing. What are you doing? They want to pitch in. Whatever you're doing, let them pitch in when they're 1.5, folding the laundry, making a mess of it. But that's when they're building the habit of community pitching in. If you wait until they're 13 and say, come on, take out the garbage, you lost that. No, you'll lose that battle. You wait. That was the wrong period of time to get them in there. Follow their interests. Always follow the interests of the child, right? All right. So if you haven't done that as a parent, play. Figure out ways to play and be silly together, because then in that spontaneity, you can rebuild your relationship. You can find ways that bring joy to you as a pair, as a family. It might take some work to figure out what works. So, and then make sure you're doing a affectionate touch. So if your vagus nerve doesn't get set properly in early life, or your oxytocin system isn't set properly, which we see in the orphans, the Romanian orphans, you may not want to touch people because it makes you reactive, right? That's a signal that something wasn't set right. So I would also find ways to have affectionate touch, just cuddling on the sofa, sitting shoulder to shoulder, and make sure you keep that through adolescence into adulthood, hugs and such. We all need that to maintain our sanity, really. And then to make sure they have opportunities for other mentors, for other people who are going to be wise advisors to them along the way. Open them up to that so that they're not isolated, so they feel like they are part of the community. And then really important is the nature immersion. Go find a sit spot, a place where you go regularly and sit, stand, lie on the ground, and get used to that place and let that place get used to you. It'll open your senses. You'll feel more connected to earth and hopefully more caring towards the rest of our communities. So I think if you're an adult and we're not talking about children, play is still the thing to do as much as possible. I know it's hard. I've written blog posts about how to play as an adult, for example. Mm-hmm. At evolvenest.org, we have 28 days. 28 days started of different things. 28 days started with an experiment that I did with college students where we wanted to nudge them to nature connection. And we had them come in and get assigned to a condition, do a pretest, and get some information about their condition. And the condition that was the experimental condition was the nature connection. We called it ecological attachment. And they would pick out of 40 some options, they picked 21 activities or to take along with them. And then for the next few weeks, they pull one activity out every day and do that all day. These are college students on campus. So for example, it was pay attention to the clouds today, or acknowledge the trees as you walk by, you know, whatever. And then they came back for post-test, and we found that their nature connection or ecological attachment increased. Their empathy for the natural world increased, their mindfulness increased. So now at evolvenest.org, we have 28 days of nature connection, which is ecoattachment.dance. And then we have 28 days of self-calming, because what you want to do, maybe I'll come back to that one. And then we have 28 days of solo play. So for adults to learn how to play, start doing it just at least alone, you know, to be silly and moving your body. And not, back to the calming. So the other thing, in my neurobiology book, I talk about, you know, the development, normal development of our compassionate morality and how it gets off kilter when we don't provide for the early needs of the young. In that book, I didn't say evolved nest. It wasn't called that. We call it evolved developmental niche, which is the fancy term for academics. but I talk about three things. So you have to learn to self-calm, because you probably get stressed out easily. So you have to pay attention to when when your jaw starts to get tight or you feel your shoulders going, you know, whatever it is, pay attention to your body signals and then learn to calm down. So you have to practice this apart from that, you know, deep belly breathing or meditation or, you know, things that get you calm down or listening to relaxing music. And then when those moments come where you start to feel stressed, to move yourself back into that state of relaxation so that you're not going into the stress response and can't think as well and can't be open-hearted, open-minded, right? So it's a process of learning those things. Now, this is hard when you're in a new situation, right? Because you're going to be a little bit apprehensive. So the second thing is to, so that's calming the older parts of the brain, what were our survival systems. The second thing that usually gets undermined in our, at least the United States, is social capacities, our relational attunement, our ability to get along. And so you have to practice that. A lot of people don't even like to be with other people. That's avoidant attachment. Right? I like you in the house, but don't come in my room kind of thing, you know. So you have to learn how to enjoy being with others. And I played folk song games with my students, my college students, to get them to be back present with one another, you know, and you're holding hands and you're singing and you're looking each other in the eye and you're laughing and you're moving your body and all this, and it's growing the right hemisphere. So you're going to be more attuned to others after that, right? So for that's really great for family development as well. So the social joy can also be fostered by just saying hello to everybody, or, you know, taking up a conversation with a stranger somehow to help the other people feel like they're connected to a community. This is we're all in this together. What is it that helps them feel that way? And then you will too, right? So various techniques there. And then the last thing, though, is our imaginations have to also be enhanced.
Yeah.
Because the narrowness of our education and the media and what we're told, you know, is how superior we humans are and who cares about anything else, and especially the white male superior guys, you know, all that weird things. So you have to select environments, experiences, books, movies that help open you up to empathy for people who are different than you, for understanding, you know, in this ancient futures film. And we have a bunch of little films. So Breaking the Cycle film, 6 minutes, Evolved Nest film, 8 minutes, and 12 minutes, Reimagining Humanity. So I encourage people to look at those. Yeah, just to try to break up this kind of very static way of being in the world and so stiff, like we're all going to die and just fall into our coffins the way we're going.
Yeah. It's lovely to hear these aspects, because it feels, you know, again, with sort of the cultural narrative and sort of the inclination towards determinism, I find, at least for myself, that it can feel somewhat hopeless when I missed it, you know, there's nothing to do. But then what I'm hearing you point to is the sort of immense adaptive capacity that we have. And then also, I mean, for me, it's felt like I'm starting to work with the flow or with life or something like that. But it might also just be that you're also working with your neurobiology, or like with our actual sort of the ways that these systems haven't trained themselves over the millennia, I guess. And then it kind of comes easy-ish if you do it, but it requires to actually do it. At least for me, it's like to do the sitting and.
Yes. Just do it. Don't think too much. Do it, right? And so sing with the energies around you, and, you know, move in.
But that might be a somber note to end on. But I wanted to kind of return to the grief component that you mentioned briefly with these grief cycles and these grief rituals. But it just feels extra pertinent to me right now, given. I mean, for Europeans, at least, you know, war in Ukraine and war in the Middle East, and these atrocities and sort of how present they are in our cognitive field, and how much of the imagery and like the violence that we get to see. I'm wondering if you have something to say on the importance of grief or like some guidance in terms of what you found there, how we can practice grieving, maybe not having to just explain or control or lock down or know that it's, oh, this is the right way or whatever. I mean, I feel a lot of those patterns going on around me, like, oh, but I've read all the history now. Of course, the Israelis are right. Or of course, the Palestinians are right. Or of course, Russia does what they do. You know, there's a lot of knowing and explaining going on versus just being with the immense horror of these events that are unfolding. And I don't know. I mean, it relates to grief for me, at least.
Yeah. And the helplessness of it. That's part of it too, right? Not being able to just stop it all. Craziness. So, yeah, I think each person can develop their own grieving ceremonies. We've lost many of them, I think, in the westernized world. So having, just lighting a candle each day to the lost lives, just taking a moment, right? Always to remember and to let yourself cry and let yourself feel. This is really hard. I mean, even without these horrible events going on, it's hard to let ourselves feel in this westernized world, the enlightenment westernized world, because, you know, that's not reasoning. Like, that's what you want to control and get out of here, because we're going to do it all with our reasonable, whatever, logic.
The productiveness. It's not productive to think and, like, to feel something and pause. That's not productive. How are you going to make money?
Right.
Speaking of the capitalist sort of voice.
That's right.
Throwing it in there.
So we have to actually overturn these systems that are killing us, are killing our life being on this, right? Our aliveness. Because capitalism and patriarchy and civilization likes everything, again, static and controllable, and that's not life. Life is unpredictable and gushy and gooey.
Yeah.
We don't like the gooiness.
No.
So we have to let ourselves laugh, too, and tell stories. That's part of healing. This is what you do usually at a funeral, for example, and tell the stories. But to wail, to have songs that bring out the sadness, to play them on the radio or play them yourself and sing along and let those emotions out, dance out those emotions. Lie on the earth and cry on earth, because earth is our mother. Everything around us is earth, right? And I think moving back to gratitude always, because gratitude opens the heart, opens the mind to receiving the beauty and the insights and the wisdom from our partners, from nature. David Bohm the physicist talked about the implicate and the explicate order. The explicate order is what we can see and touch and measure. The implicate order, it's coming out of the implicate order, which is what we can't see, but has everything in it. It's like the universe of possibilities. And so we have to open ourselves to that universe of possibilities and be ready to receive the new, the novel, the insights that are going to guide us in a heart-centered way. We want to cultivate that heart, which means you have to feel. And a lot of times if we've been abused or undercared for, we don't want to feel because we think we're going to just fall into the abyss of pain and despair, which we felt when we were little. But with therapy or with, you know, once you move into that space and you realize, oh, you're not going to die by feeling that pain, then you can let it go and then the wound can heal, right? So we've got all these Velcro protection devices on us that are covering our heart and our openness. And it takes a little, you know, peeling it off is a little painful. But once you, you know, peel off that onion of pain, of wounds, you can actually be a spirit and be okay, be, you know, spiritually present, emotionally present, relationally present, physically present, all here, all coordinated, and then actually be a force for positive change. Because we're all vibratory matter, right? And our vibrations are being sent out. So if we're all angry or we're sad all the time, we're sending out vibrations that aren't going to help transform the world. We want to be back in that space where we can be fully letting the implicate orders, love and flow of life through us. We are little mirrors, or we are little radar systems, and that's all going out there. It sounds very unscientific, but it's actually scientific. So it's just not the westernized way of looking at, you know, the little static things. This is the flow of quantum physics. This is the native science, indigenous science, so of the Native Americans and others. So getting back to our being present. So I think grieving is really important for that, to be present now, here, relating now, and enhancing the life around us. I think that's our main responsibility. That's what virtue is about. It's not about me and mine. It's about us, all of us, on the planet together.
Mm. Yeah. Maybe that's a good good pause point for right now. Unless there is there something else that you would want to bring in that I didn't, that we didn't touch on?
Well, I guess I could also say that everybody has their own idea of spirituality, whether you want to just not pay attention to it at all, or you have some notion of it, our metaphysic, our worldview. So I subscribe to the what's called the indigenous worldview. My colleague Four Arrows has been writing about that for a long time. He and I have put a book out last year, Restoring the Kinship Worldview, which is the indigenous worldview. This is one that is very integrative. So it integrates native science and just the embracing of everyone, whoever they are, and honoring uniqueness, providing for basic needs. And I mean, there's like 40 precepts he's identified. And I think it's really important to think about these, because people usually intellectually agree with the indigenous worldview, and, you know, like emphasis on heart over head, earth systems and all systems are living and loving. People say, oh, yeah, yeah. But then he asked people, well, look at your practices and look at your workplace and the institutions. Are they over here on the on the indigenous worldview sign? Oh, no, they're more head than heart. They are treating Earth as an unloving it. And so, so I think understanding that our deep, deep intuitions are, you know, indigenous worldview, but our systems that we've been forced into are not. And the shifting is really important. And part of the indigenous worldview for me is understanding that we are just here in these life forms now. If we destroy this world, like many other worlds have been destroyed, according to the Hopi, we've messed up many other worlds. We're coming back. We just may not be in these forms, right? These ego forms. So I'm not worried about not ending and perishing and being obliterated forever when I die. No, I'll be back. And I think that gives me some sense of comfort. So that's the spiritual piece for me, keeps me going. But we want to set things up for the next world so that it's nurturing and nourishing and loving and holistically fulfilling. And so that's the work I'm doing, is trying to set things up so that people have a pathway. Remember the pathway. Hopefully people now will remember the pathway, and we won't destroy the planet and this world the way it is. But if we do, then we're going to set the seeds for the future.
Yeah, that's a strong resonance. And I mean, for me as well, like you talk of play and you talk of these relational aspects of like just refocusing on them and the presence of them here, sort of the liveliness, the squishy stuff, the weird and the uncanny and the things that are like doesn't make any sense at all, because, you know, or like things that happen for no reason, and like all of those language, you know, things are very interesting to recenter on and to pay attention to, and then there's so much joy and energy and flow there, here, right now. And then my biological being may stop being here because of whatever might happen. But then, I don't know. It's just a way of living, like just being with life, which is very fulfilling right now.
And your corpse, all of you are going into the next generations. I mean, you're not disappearing. You're going to be earth dust, right? No. Stardust, or you know, or a combination.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the greatest services that I think Swedish television has done. There was this show when I was growing up, and the tagline, the end line that every show always ended with was sort of the first law of thermodynamics: like, so nothing disappears, everything's here always. Like, because it was about a place where they were doing, and that was like every morning, every summer, we just watched that like for a while, and then there was that tagline. So it's like embedded in me, in my DNA, and that's just like wonderful. I'm wondering if people want to find you online or read more about the Evolved Nest or take part of the resources, where should they go? I'll put the links in there, but if you'd mention them, that'd be great.
Sure.
And they will also be in the show notes.
First, go to evolvenest.org, and there the three films are, and we have an Evolved Nest curriculum that you can follow on your own or with a group. You can download the PDF, and has video links to videos and podcasts and such. And then another one would be reimagininghumanity.org. That's that more recent film. There's also breakingthecyclefilm.org. And my website, darshanarvaez.com. And then I have a university website as well, the University of Notre Dame, but that website's hard to say.
Navigate, yeah.
Well, that's probably enough.
I'll find it. That's great. Thank you so much for taking the time. I really appreciate this conversation.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Anne.